Put yourself in her shoes today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Simin worked as a journalist in Iran, but she dreamed of a new life in Germany.
I left Iran to find democracy and a better life. I'm not here for economic reasons. I'm following my dream.
Her journey to Europe has been a painful one, though, and now she's stuck in Croatia, where even police officers mistreat her.
The officer told me that I was a filthy refugee. I thought that Iranian police were bad, but police here is worse.
We'll hear her story, plus a Nigerian playwright weighs in on what women everywhere need to do to get more power.
Get to work. Because if you sit around and wait to be handed power from the people in power, you're never going to get it.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Not a day goes by that I don't think about the massive number of people on the move around our planet. Millions and millions of people. Just count refugees alone, 20 million of them fleeing something horrible, searching for a safer life. We've seen this play out in Europe, people overcrowding boats, crossing from Turkey to Greece and Libya to Italy, crowds hoping for that better life, marching down highways on their way north and west. But in 2016, a lot of countries in Europe closed their borders, and all those humans we had seen, they got stuck at borders all along the so-called migrant trail. We followed this story closely for 2 years now, and we sent The World's Richard Hall to check in on one woman, a journalist from Iran who is stuck in Croatia. We're only using her first name to protect her identity.
Hi, Richard. Nice to meet you. How are you?
I meet Simin in a refugee center in Zagreb, which is an old rundown former hotel for railway workers. It's way out on the edge of town and there's not much to do here. She looks tired and worn out as she tells me what it was like when she first arrived here at the center. When Simin reached Europe, she thought the hardest part of her journey was behind her. She left her native Iran, where she had lived all of her 44 years, because she feared for her life. She was a political journalist who attracted the attention of authorities. They threatened to arrest her, so she left before they could. But it was when she was in Serbia that the worst happened. She was trying to cross into Croatia when she was raped by two smugglers, themselves migrants from Afghanistan.
The smugglers forced me to be with them. He threatened to not let me get in the car if I refused being with him. I had to do it. I was a woman alone, all on my own.
Simin's story is one of many similar accounts from women who have made the same journey. Rights groups say women face assault, harassment, and sexual violence at every step of the way along the migrant trail, including on European soil. A 2016 report by Amnesty International, which collected testimony from 40 women who had made the journey, found that in almost all of the countries they passed through, they experienced physical abuse, including being groped or pressured to have sex by smugglers, security staff, or other refugees. And it's getting worse. Since the height of the migrant crisis in 2015, Europe has closed its borders, forcing the migrant trail underground. This has made it even more dangerous for women. Simin's ordeal didn't end with the smuggler. She was alone in a country she didn't know. The men took her money and her cell phone. She had nowhere to turn.
I endured many hardships. I've developed psychological problems. I was hospitalized for a while.
After her attack, Simin had to try to cross the border into Croatia again. She says the police there treated her terribly.
We had to walk through a forest at night. My shoes were torn. I had a different image of this place. I was mistreated by the police after my capture. The officer told me that I was a filthy refugee. They said, "We don't want you here." I thought that Iranian police were bad, but police here is worse. I knew Iran wasn't a democracy, but there is no democracy here either.
Simin has been through so much, but she feels like she's still on the same painful journey. She can't move on from what happened to her, not for as long as she is in Croatia. She says she has bad memories here. The problem is, she's not allowed to leave.
I wanted to go to Germany. That's why I left Iran. I thought I could work there, but I was fingerprinted here.
The fingerprinting she refers to is what happens to all migrants and refugees when they are registered by the United Nations. European Union rules mean that a migrant must claim asylum in the country they are first registered. Some managed to make it all the way to Germany without being caught. Simin wasn't so lucky.
I left Iran to find democracy and a better life. I'm not here for economic reasons. I'm following my dream. I have many friends in Germany. My friends are journalists and reporters. I think I can work there as a writer. I can make better progress in my field of study there.
She says, I feel like I'm experiencing a slow death in this cage. Simin has tried to leave the country more than once. A week before we met, she crossed the border from Croatia into Slovenia, trying to get to Germany again. But she was picked up by authorities there and sent back here. This is not uncommon. No matter how far along you get, your details are checked on a shared database and you're always sent back to the place you are first fingerprinted. And here's something that's important to understand. Almost none of the refugees here planned to stay in Croatia. It's just not somewhere most of them had heard of before they set out on their journey. There were only 1,000 asylum applications here in 2017, compared to 150,000 in Germany. And Simin has more reasons than most for wanting to escape Croatia.
When I'm arrested, humiliated, told that I'm not welcomed here, and ask why I'd come here, I can't.
So now Simin's life is on hold. She's stuck here with all the bad memories of what happened to her, living in limbo. But she's insistent that her journey isn't over. They have my fingerprint, she says, but I'll try to leave again. I'll die if I stay here. For the World, Richard Hall in Zagreb, Croatia.
Simin is stuck physically in Croatia and seems stuck in a cycle of abuse, a life in limbo. That limbo of abuse runs through a piece of theater I saw last week, a play whose impact is honestly still with me. It's called Hear Word by Nigerian playwright and director Ifeoma Fafunwa. And a warning for you, some excerpts from the play that we're going to hear contain disturbing and graphic material. One of the opening vignettes is about a Nigerian girl who refuses to prepare plantains for a man who's about to become her uncle. Fafunwa told me it's based on some experiences she had growing up.
A 14-year-old or 13-year-old girl is left alone at home, or so we think, and an uncle who is marrying her aunt shows up. The uncle is being treated like a king because the aunt is over 40 years old and the family is desperate to get her married.
She is old and she has no husband. I'm not supposed to say that though, but...
So when the child is left alone, the uncle uses sort of like, oh, you're not respectful, takes her into the visitor's toilet and then molests her there.
And then he put that his smelly mouth on my mouth and his tongue was trying to enter, but I closed my mouth tight. So it was just going round and round like one slimy catfish. And so he had to stop. Then he put me on top of the toilet and he was saying, Teresa, I like you, huh? I like you, I like you. And then I saw his big chuku-chuku, I just froze.
And what she sees at the end is, because the play starts with, my mother said I should keep quiet and stop talking nonsense because that is the uncle that's going to marry our aunt.
I won't talk again. I'm not saying anything. Maybe I will even run away from this house. I didn't do anything.
And so it's that shutting up of a child's voice.
My mommy says I should keep quiet and stop talking rubbish.
Because of the embarrassment, because even as a rape victim, you're better off shutting up because your chances of marriage are lowered.
So Ifeoma, what is your take on Western, in quotation marks, feminism? How is it different from its Nigerian counterpart?
African women have always been feminists. I look at this in its historic context and I say colonialism, the evangelic movement, Christianity and corruption, which is a lack of education, have made Nigerian women forget the strong women in history, the strong women who represented positions of leadership in religion, spirituality, politics, and culture. When the British arrived, they removed most of the posts. And when they reinstalled chiefs, they were all men. So women lost power there. So if you come fast forward to the present, it's frowned upon. When you say the word feminist in Nigeria, it sort of conjures up this like unattractive thing. And that's because Nigerians are also looking at the way the West presents feminism. This place, I was particular in creating this play for Africans to embrace it. It's a play with lights and color, and they're sexy and it's funny. And I think for me, the feminist work that I've seen in Europe is always sort of angst-filled and angry. Mm. And
yet some of the discussion on social media about Hear Word is that, oh, wow, this is a global thing. I mean, what I see in Nigeria, I see here in the U.S., I see here in France or wherever people are seeing it.
Yes. More and more, I've spent time thinking about the ways in which patriarchy manifests itself here in America. When you see a baller with three girls on one side of him and the other, when you see a hip-hop star.
How is the Me Too hashtag being discussed in Nigeria?
People are asking, where's Aaron? You know, when are Nigerian women going to get on board and start?
Nigerian women aren't just kind of picking up Me Too and using it?
No, they are not picking it up because there's no law and order. So if you call a man out in Nigeria now, what's that going to do for you? You'll just lose your job. We don't have the systems in place to handle it. And even in America, it's really tied to money and consumerism. So you remove a man from one position because his customers or the consumers won't like him there anymore.
If I can ask, Ifeoma, I gather these themes of abuse hit home for you personally.
Yes. I think almost 8 or 9 out of 10 Nigerian women have experienced some form of molestation before the age of 15. There's almost no one who hasn't felt had been groped or, you know, or fondled or put in a corner somewhere or locked in a room or chased, you know, around the table by some man with his pants down. It's just part of the environment in Nigeria, and it's part of the environment here.
What do you say to men, especially Nigerian men, who say, this isn't about me?
In all societies where patriarchy is so pervasive, women actually keep it going. And so in a way, even though men haven't thought about what I just said, they are not responsible in that way. And they're also not responsible because this story shouldn't really be about them. And that's where this Hear Word differs from the feminist pieces of work you see around the world. This piece says to the victim, it's about you. Make your own change, shift your mindset about you and what's possible for you and what's possible for women in the world, and get to work. Because if you sit around and wait to be handed power from the people in power, you're never going to get it. Nobody's going to give up power voluntarily. It's not instinctive. So yes, it's not about them in that way. But are they predators? Are they selfish? Yes. Are they entitled? Yes. It's a privilege that's handed to them as a man that you are superior to women and that women are here to serve you and to make you feel like a king. That's the way women are trained in Nigeria, and that's what men believe.
Ifeoma Fafunwa is the founder of Eye Open Eye, a Nigerian production company driving social change through performance art. She's also the author and director of the play Hear Word, Niger Women Talk True. Thanks so much for your time. It was great to have this conversation.
Thank you so much.
That story comes courtesy of our Across Women's Lives desk. You can find more of our coverage at PRI.org. Just ahead, students in Moscow are offered a rare snow day. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to the world. Taking down statues of historic figures centuries after they've been erected. We've seen that happening recently from Charlottesville, Virginia to Cape Town, South Africa. But this next story is about putting up a memorial, and in this case, it may not help U.S.-Russian relations. Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov was never shy about criticizing President Vladimir Putin. And then 3 years ago, Nemtsov was killed not far from the Kremlin. Five people have gone to prison for the murder, but Nemtsov's supporters believe the order to kill him came from much higher up. Moscow won't give him a statue, but the Washington, D.C. City Council is taking up the cause. Here's more from my BBC colleague Gary O'Donohue.
So here I am outside the Russian embassy. There's a big sign up here on the wall, both in Latin and Cyrillic script. There are cameras on some of the lampposts around me. There's a couple of fences. There's a huge satellite dish just inside the grounds. But in a few weeks' time, this little stretch of Wisconsin Avenue is going to be renamed Boris Nemtsov Plaza on the third anniversary of his murder.
You're trying to erase his memory. We're going to keep it alive. Here it is, right out in front of your embassy.
That's the sound of the Washington City Council pitting itself against the might of the Russian state, and in particular, Mary Che, who's pushed through emergency legislation so the renaming of the street can be done in time for that third anniversary. If the Russians won't memorialise Boris Nemtsov's death, she says, then Washington will.
The idea that somebody who was fighting for democracy would then have to face the attempt by government officials to effectively wipe away his memory so angered me and moved me that I thought, yes, we will keep his memory alive here where it can't be obliterated.
Переименование городской совет поддержал единогласно, а вот на общественных слушаниях инициативу поддержали не все. Жители Вашингтона Джереми Бигвуду, правда, угрожали отключить.
The outcry in Russia has been substantial. State TV says maybe Moscow should have an Edward Snowden Street. Vladimir Putin's spokesman bemoaned the fact that relations were already bad enough without this. But one Russian who is happy is Vladimir Karamurza, a longtime friend of the murdered opposition leader and head of the Boris Nemtsov Freedom Foundation.
We have streets in Moscow named after Hugo Chavez, the late Venezuelan dictator. We have a street in Moscow named after Ahmad Kadyrov, the former Kremlin-appointed strongman in Chechnya, who once declared a jihad against Russia. But a former deputy prime minister of Russia, regional governor, four-term member of the Russian parliament, is apparently off limits.
The murder of Boris Nemtsov brought thousands onto the streets of Moscow. His supporters in no doubt that his criticism of Vladimir Putin's annexation of Ukraine the real reason for his death. The Russian embassy here didn't respond to our request for an interview or for a statement. It seems unlikely they'll want to attend the unveiling of the street signs. But Vladimir Karamurza says one day they will embrace it, as they did with the communist-era dissident Andrei Sakharov, who got the street outside the then-embassy named after him. And it will serve, he says, to show Americans a different side to Russia.
All people hear about Russia in US media is about dictatorship and wars and meddling in elections and hacking and all these sorts of things. It'll be an important reminder that that's not all there is about Russia. That there are also honorable and decent people in Russia, like Boris Nemtsov, who are prepared to stand up for the values of democracy and freedom.
Vladimir Karamurza there, head of the Boris Nemtsov Freedom Foundation. Ending that report from the BBC's Gary O'Donohue in Washington. Now to some lighter news out of Moscow. It's snowy. I know that might not sound like news, but I'm talking about record-breaking levels of snow. Sergei Goryashko is in Moscow with our partners at the BBC.
The city looks like a huge pile of snow right now. There are a lot of traffic jams on the road unless the emergency services urge drivers to use public transport. More than a month's worth of snow fell in Moscow within just 36 hours at the weekend. And this is the biggest snowfall at the Russian capital since meteorological records began. So Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin has already called the event like the snowfall of the century. Over 2,000 trees collapsed under the weight of snow. Even one person is dead. But now the emergency services are working to clean the streets up. And, well, the city is trying to deal with this huge amount of snow.
I mean, a few weeks ago, we were talking about virtually zero snow in Moscow. As abnormal as this very large amount of snow seems to be. But just check me on that. What is more abnormal in Moscow? Tons of snow or no snow? And is this difference kind of confusing people?
Well, actually, over the last, I believe, decade, it's more normal when there is no snow at all, even in winter. It's just cold, but it's not snowing so much. this sort of situation that we have today is really extraordinary for the city. I've never seen anything like that, and people, I think, are also shocked with such an amount of snow.
How are you personally coping, Sergei?
Well, I had to go to my metro station just by myself. I couldn't use the bus. And today there were a lot of traffic jams on the streets, and I thought it was more comfortable just to walk a bit. Actually, it was not so comfortable at all because the streets weren't cleaned in the morning. There were just a lot of snow, and I had to like feel myself like in an Arctic. But still, it was sort of fun.
Sergei Goryashko, the BBC's correspondent in Moscow, thanks very much.
Thank you.
One sign that all the snow in Moscow is a huge deal, school attendance was voluntary today. Not exactly a snow day, more like it snowed a ton so you don't have to go to class if you don't want to day. Hey, it's a Russian thing. So I called up a high school student in Moscow, Agatha Gilman, to find out more. Since her father is American, she grew up bilingual. Agatha's in her last year at Moscow State School number 1514.
Hello.
Hello, Agatha. Agatha, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, fantastic. I heard that school in Moscow was voluntary today.
It was. It was kind of a test for people who really like going to school.
Yeah. So did you go or did you take the snow day?
I went because I have a lot of guilt, but I probably wouldn't have otherwise.
How many students actually showed up today?
8 out of 30.
In your class. And are there more snow days being offered the rest of this week? Or do you think everybody's going to have to go back to school starting tomorrow?
Well, I think it's actually a very big exception, the snow day, because it's not like we live in Nice or Morocco. I mean, things happen like this in Moscow. So I don't think that we'd be expecting many more snow days, maybe only tomorrow, but then ordinary.
And tell me, when you look out your window right now, what are you seeing? What does it look like outside right now?
It really looks like something from a fairy tale because there are huge icicles on the roofs, like, I don't know, in feet, probably 2 feet long or 3 feet long. And all the trees are kind of bending down from the snow.
Sounds beautiful, though. How did you hear about the snow day? Because here in the Boston area, the kids, they are on the TV and the radio and trying to look out for the latest last minute updates of what's closed and what's open. I suspect with very few snow days, you probably just wait for somebody to tell you.
Well, I only found out this morning when I was on the subway on my way to school. So,
Agatha, you sound like a very serious student. How are your grades?
They're good, but I'm really not a serious student. I just, I'm a hedonist student.
No, there's a place for hedonist students, too. It's a good place. Agatha Gilman, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. When it comes to women's Olympic ice hockey, there's only one Korean team, but two different ways to say pass the puck.
In South Korea, they just say pass. In North Korean, they say yolak, which can mean get in touch with the puck.
We'll get in touch with the lingo of Korea's unified Olympic hockey team, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
Do you know anyone else called Marco Werman?
That's Patrick Cox of our language podcast, The World in Words. And Patrick, no, I don't. I've only met a few Marcos in my entire life and one other Werman, and never the combination together except for myself. What about you? Any Patrick Coxes out there?
Well, there is a famous Canadian shoe designer. He's rich and handsome. So just like me, really. Anyway, we've been taking a look in the podcast about whether sharing a name with a famous person changes you. A little later on, we're going to hear from a documentary filmmaker. She's making a film about people in a certain part of India who are called Stalin and Lenin, a whole bunch of them. But first, I want to introduce you to someone else with a well-known name, though in this case, it's inadvertent.
My name is Ivanka Majic, and I am 43 years old. My father was called Ivan, and my grandmother was called Eva. And my parents decided that Ivanka was a more modern, updated version of Eva.
In some Slavic countries, Ivanka is a popular name, including among the Croats of Croatia and Bosnia. That's where Ivanka Majic's father was from. Her mother's from Britain, hence the accent. Ivanka's British. She works as a digital consultant. And because of that job, she's been an early adopter of all things digital. So when Facebook came along, she signed up, even when the rest of us thought it was just some kind of college hookup thing. Likewise, Twitter.
Twitter was a very new, this idea of this social media was very new. So I signed up and my name's Ivanka, so I went for Ivanka. I didn't really think it through.
Yes. Ivanka Majic, resident of Brighton, England, self-employed, married, one child. She snagged the Twitter handle at Ivanka. I almost don't need to tell you what happened next.
I started getting messages like, you know, I either don't like your shoes or I like your shoes or what were you wearing or stuff like that. But also things like, I'd like to start a business. Please, could you ask your father to give me some money?
This kind of stuff sometimes completely took over Ivanka's Twitter feed, which makes what happened next just that little bit more head spinning. The day was January 17th, 2017, 3 days before Trump's inauguration.
I woke up, my husband gets up, picks up his phone and goes, oh, ITV News wants to talk to you.
First one TV station.
And I'm delighted to say that Ivanka joins us on the phone now.
Then another.
Yes. It was favourited 15,000 times, more
15,000.
Than...
15,000.
Then another. Here's what had happened. For the millionth time, someone on Twitter had confused her with Ivanka Trump. The tweet actually was a quote. It said, at Ivanka, space, Trump. Is great, a woman with real character and class. No biggie, except that this tweet was then retweeted by
Donald Trump last night meant to put his daughter Ivanka Trump into a tweet.
Because it was a program about her.
The tweeter in chief had been a little hasty. He hadn't noticed the tweet was directed at the wrong Ivanka. So the British Ivanka was having her 15 minutes of fame and not really enjoying it.
One of the TV stations phoned up and asked to come down to film me in the house to talk about how I'm classy or is Ivanka Trump classy, or the way it was phrased just made me angry. Why would you come to my house just because of some nonsense?
Which was when she decided to turn the nonsense into substance. With the help of some friends, she drafted a responding tweet to the soon-to-be president that said this. And you're a man with great responsibilities. May I suggest more care on Twitter and more time learning about hashtag climate change? And then she also included a graphic showing the overwhelming belief among scientists that climate change is caused by humans. What was the response to the tweet? Did you get the kind of response that you were looking for?
I think I did. I obviously didn't get a response from the President of the United States, the future, what's he when they're President-elect? But the point that I wanted to get across was about climate change. Given everything, and I think I did the best I could in the circumstances.
That's really interesting. I mean, it sounds as though you've leveraged the coincidence of just having the same name as the President's daughter and having this confusion on Twitter to your advantage, or to at least to the advantage of an argument that you kind of wanted to put out there.
Yes, I think I tried to move the conversation away from, you know, accidental tweets.
Accidental tweets based on mistaken identity are, well, really common. There just aren't that many names in the world. People are constantly making the wrong connections. Just the people who are associated with Donald Trump, many of them have Twitter doppelgangers. There's a Mike Pence whose bio states he is, quote, not a Christo-fascist politician. There's a Scottish Steve Bannon who mainly tweets about golf. There's another Scot, an office worker called Kellyanne Conway. And there's George Papadopoulos, not the former Trump campaign aide who allegedly told an Australian diplomat that Russia had, quote, political dirt on Hillary Clinton, and who later pleaded guilty to making a false statement to the FBI. Not him, but George Papadopoulos, certified public accountant who does business in a suburb of Detroit and flies to Greece to look after his mom. A lot of these people put a brave, jovial face on their accidental notoriety. But just imagine the thousands of hate messages they must get. Humanity probably doesn't seem all that nice to them. These people are the coincidentally famous. There's another bunch of people who acquired their famous names very differently. They were chosen for them by their parents. This song is well known in Kerala. That's a state in India, way down in the south of the country. Kerala has a proud tradition of a type of politics that's not exactly in fashion these days. Communism. It's not one-party rule. Communists are elected there, and they have been on and off since 1957, which makes Kerala either the first or the second place in the world where communists came to power via elections. This song celebrates that. The lyrics are all about martyrs and revolutionaries who died for the cause. And if you're in Kerala during election season, you'll likely hear this blaring out of one of many communist campaign trucks.
My parents are Malayalis, and people from Kerala are known as Malayalis because the state language in that part of India, it's Malayalam.
This is Kavita Pillai. She's a documentary filmmaker who grew up just outside Cleveland.
You know, we would take trips to Kerala every few years to go visit our relatives. And as soon as you arrive, you see hammers and sickles everywhere. And I would say, if you think of, say, the frequency with which you see stop signs or billboards in the U.S., it's probably with that kind of regularity. And so I grew up in a kind of conservative Midwestern suburb under Ronald Reagan. And so going from Reagan's America to Kerala, where you see hammers and sickles everywhere, it was pretty stark. Like, even as a kid, you know, like, something's up. Yeah, and this would not fly back in Ohio. We're not in Ohio anymore. In 2005, I ended up going to India on my own on a year-long research fellowship. And pretty soon after I arrived, I met a young boy named Stalin. So I asked him how he got his name. You know, he didn't know anything. He was only 12 at the time. But his mom was there, and his mother said, oh, well, in our town, there's a bunch of Stalins. You know, I had to know more about this. And it turns out that there's not just Stalins and Lenins. I mean, Stalin and Lenin are relatively common, but there are Khrushchevs and Brezhnevs and Pushkin. There's someone named after Yuri Gagarin. There's women named after, whose first names are Tereshkova, after Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space. There's kids named Pravda, which means truth. The one father who I met his two-year-old was named Pravda, and I asked him, and he said, you know, we could have given her the name Satya, which means truth in Sanskrit. He said, but he was a fervent communist, and so he said, but I wanted to name her Pravda. There's one Stalin, you know, in particular who kind of stands out to me. He's a bureaucrat in his mid-50s. He's a fervent environmentalist. He also has, like, a menagerie of lots of animals, and he's a recovering alcoholic. And he is a ardent admirer of his namesake. So he's saying that these days people don't even know the name of their grandfather's father, but this particular day on which I interviewed him, it was Stalin's birthday. So he's saying, this particular day is a holy day. How lucky am I, because I was named after Stalin, who is the most handsome man I've seen in my life. Just look at that mustache. What a masculine face. You know, I asked him, this is a man who's best known for killing tens of millions of people, of his own countrymen. And what's your response to that? And His response was always, you know, some version of Stalin united many small countries to make the great Soviet Union. And yeah, there were some atrocities along the way, but it takes some talent to do that. You know, I'm someone who can't even kill a chicken. It takes some talent to do these cruel acts, and the ends justified the means. People are certainly naming their children after other global popular figures as well. I've heard of a Roosevelt, Lincoln, Kennedy. I'm told that Kennedy's son's name is Clinton. I've heard of a Nixon.
Any Trumps yet?
I thought there might be. But the thing is, people are very aware of how Trump is affecting Indian workers. So they say, oh, he's trying to kick our people out of the U.S., so we don't like him. The other thing is people associate Donald with Donald Duck. And Trump, you don't find a lot of one-syllable names in Kerala. So maybe if Trump's name had two syllables, maybe he would be more popular. But I think, you know, nowadays people are just much more well-versed with what's going on with Donald Trump, as opposed to in the past, people would not have known as much about what Stalin and Lenin were up to. They didn't have social media to inform them on a, you know, minute-by-minute basis. I think of this story as a tragicomedy. It was initially the name Stalin and Lenin were an inroad into looking at kind of these contradictions and even hypocrisies in Kerala. The fact that Kerala espouses all this like communist rhetoric and workers of the world unite, but the state is kept afloat by the fact that millions of workers from Kerala go to uber capitalist places in the oil-rich Gulf, right? They're going to Dubai and Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Oman and sending millions and millions of dollars back to India. Communism is kept alive in Kerala by capitalism, essentially. So that was the story that I was looking at. So when people would say, you know, these things to me about the likes of Lenin and Stalin, I didn't see it for what it was. And my ideas about this changed a lot after the 2016 U.S. election. It was at that time that I realized that what I had been ignoring was actually, you know, kind of a symptom of this, almost like this disease within our species. So in the wake of the U.S. presidential election, I suddenly realized that people saying things like, Stalin and Lenin were great leaders, they committed some atrocities, but they did it to make Russia great again. Suddenly it didn't seem like outliers. Suddenly it felt like a version of a lot of what we were hearing here. It's like, so what if, you know, Donald Trump said and did such and such? He's doing it to make America great again. This was no longer just like contained by the boundaries of Kerala. It was a reflection of just stuff that is in our species, really, like this reverence for, quote, strong leaders who will do whatever it takes in the minds of some in order to, like, enact their vision.
Filmmaker Kavita Pillay there. Fascinating, Patrick. And that last point she was making there about a certain style of leader, that's pretty subtle stuff.
Yeah, right. I mean, she's not equating Stalin and Trump in terms of, you know, what they've said or done, but she is equating how we make allowances for strongman leaders.
So what do you all think? Does having a famous name change you?
Well, in a place like Kerala, maybe it does a little bit, especially if you come from a lower caste, because in giving you a name like that, your family is thumbing its nose at India's caste system. And among some of the people who are profiled in this film, it does seem that being named Stalin or Lenin or Kennedy or whatever it is, it can be empowering.
So how do I see this film, Patrick? It sounds pretty cool.
Well, it's still in production. The working title is Stalin, Lenin, and Other Tales from South India. Should be out later this year.
Oh, I love the title. Patrick Cox, co-host of our podcast, The World in Words. Thanks as always.
You're welcome, Marco.
Okay, breathing a little easier about the prospect of nuclear war. We have been hearing a lot about improving relations between South Korea and its neighbor to the north. Maybe that's why. And this weekend, while you may have been paying attention to another high-profile sporting event, we got to see some of that thawing of tensions between the two Koreas play out on the ice. I'm talking about a friendly Olympic prelim match over the weekend between Sweden and Korea's newly unified women's ice hockey team. It's got players from both North and South Korea, And as part of a deal between the two sides, the team gets to compete at the Winter Olympics, which start in South Korea later this week. But bringing these players together has had its challenges. We reached out to reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, who was at yesterday's game.
This is not like a normal Korean ice hockey game. First, the national anthem. There is none. They can't play the North Korean national anthem nor the South Korean national anthem for these events. So instead, they play an old Korean folk song called Arirang. Members of the team stood up for that during the opening of this friendly match. Also the flag, not a North Korean flag, not a South Korean flag. Instead, they have a white banner with a blue outline of a unified Korean peninsula on it. So there are certain sensitivities that must be kept in mind in forming this team. But on the ice, the players did just fine. Marco, even though the unified Korean team lost to Sweden 3-1, the team's coach, Canadian Sarah Murray, said her athletes are improving, although they've had to overcome some linguistic challenges.
For our team meetings, it's going through to English, to South Korean, to North Korean. So the meetings take three times as long, and it's really hard when, you know, you have three different languages on one team.
So, Jason, do you have an example or two of how sports lingo differs between North Korean Korean and South Korean Korean?
Sure thing. One example is the word for goalie or goalkeeper. In South Korean, they say the English word, essentially, they say goalkeeper. In North Korean, it's munjigi, which more or less means gate protector, gatekeeper. Another word is pass, certainly an essential word on the ice. In South Korea, they just say pass. In North Korean, they say yolak, which can mean get in contact or get in touch. Usually here in South Korea, people say that when they want someone to give them a phone call. Yolak ejuseo, give me a call. But in North Korea, it's, you know, meant to get in touch with the puck.
Wow, that's really interesting. So South Korea really relying more on those English terms and North Korea going with Korean terms. So the women's hockey team, Jason, will this be the only merged team at the Winter Olympics?
It's the only unified team at the Olympics, although North and South Korean athletes will march into the stadium together during the opening ceremony this Friday.
So with these cultural differences almost foisted on both teams and really both countries, how are average South Koreans reacting to, I don't know, this somewhat artificial kumbaya moment?
Well, a survey that came out at the end of January, just after this unified team was announced, didn't look so good. It said 70% of South Koreans were not in favor of it. I actually spoke to one guy recently. His name is John Lee. He told me why he's opposed to the hockey team, as well as North and South Korean athletes marching under a unified Korean flag.
I was in the Korean army, and I did not salute that flag. That flag is not the flag that draped over the coffins of my fellow soldiers who died because of the North Koreans. That flag does not represent my country. It doesn't represent my beliefs. It's a phony political rag. I don't care much about it at all. And Minjok, those are the guys who are threatening to turn my country into a sea of fire.
What John is referring to are two incidents in 2010. One was the sinking of the Chonan naval corvette. That was a South Korean ship. Over 40 South Korean sailors died when that ship went down, and investigators say North Korea torpedoed it. Then there was also Yongpyeong Island. That's an island in the Yellow Sea that North Korea shelled in late 2010, and some South Korean Marines died during that attack.
Yeah, hard not to see the political value of all this stuff. I'm just curious, how much you think South Korean media will be focusing on relationships between the North and the South? Or is it mostly going to be about the sports?
I think the South Korean media will do its best to focus on the games. The South Korean government has really put in a lot of effort to try to make the Olympics go off without a hitch. But, you know, the Olympics and North Korea's involvement certainly have provided us here with a reprieve from all the rhetoric that really characterized last year, mainly between Pyongyang and Washington. And I think South Koreans are breathing a little easier right now that there isn't a missile test going on almost every day, or that President Trump is not currently threatening to totally destroy North Korea, or for that matter, North Korea isn't threatening to turn South Korea into a sea of fire right now. So I feel the Olympics is creating a good amount of goodwill here on the peninsula.
Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
Finally today, I'm always curious how foreign versions of American TV shows play out. In France, there's a lot of buzz today about an episode over the weekend of the French edition of The Voice, the TV singing contest.
I heard there was a secret chord.
Yep, one of the judges heard the first words out of this young woman's mouth, and 4 seconds later hit the big red button. That's a positive, by the way. The judge pledged to coach the singer. The singer's name is Manel Ibtissem, and her family has roots in Syria. She had selected Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah and was about to proceed to a verse in Arabic when this happened. Two more judges buzzed in almost simultaneously. Everybody, it seemed, wanted to work with young Manel. Literally everyone, 4 for 4. When Manel was done performing, the audience gave her a standing ovation that lasted nearly a minute. On social media today, there's a lot of similar buzz. There are also detractors pointing to comments Manel made on social media, comments she's since taken down in which she questioned who was really behind the truck attack in Nice in 2016. There are also the nasty comments aimed at the fact that Manel, a Muslim woman, appeared on stage with a head covering. Worth noting, too, that a recent poll in France found that 60% believe Islam is a threat to the French Republic. Anyway, it's all blowing up on the internet, and we'll be following Manel's progress on The Voice in France. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.